You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on my podcast this week is Zohar Bronfman, CEO of Pecan AI.
You can sell things, especially to larger organizations, you can sell things that actually don't have ROI. You can sell things that either look shiny, sound shiny, or smell shiny, or all of the above. Yeah. But ultimately, if you put yourself in a rigorous test of, you know, did I make a change? Did I actually added value to the system? The answer could have been no in many cases. And for us, it was something we couldn't accept.
This is Zohar. We dig into how we rejected the AI magic wand narrative to build predictive capabilities for companies that cannot afford data science teams. You'll hear how depreciating a profitable feature actually improves retention, and why his smallest team achieved more than his largest. The conversation reveals what happens when you choose real value over impressive demos, and why Pecan almost never loses customers. Well, hi, Zohar. Thanks for making the time available today and being the guest on my podcast.
Hi, Ton. It's my pleasure.
That's a good way to start. I've been looking forward to this, by the way. I've seen your journey. I've seen that it's been going in phases, which is always interesting to understand what happened when and how did the growth really happen? What stuck? Before we start talking about your company, a little bit about you. What drives you as an entrepreneur? What gives you energy?
My background before starting Pecan is mostly academic. So I've spent quite a lot of time researching both AI and also philosophy, actually, from the other side of things. So I would say that there are two things that make me very, very satisfied or happy. One would be curiosity, figuring out and finding surprises, solving problems, being creative. I think we'll probably talk about AI down the road. I think that specific aspect of the human mind is probably the most remarkable one, and probably also the hardest to emulate. So I'm definitely in a place where I love seeing new situations, try to understand why something is working or isn't working, and just try to figure it out. Curiosity would be number one, and problem solving. The other one obviously is very much related to what I'm doing today and for the last 7 years in high intensity. I can't even start and explain what kick I'm getting from helping businesses adopt AI. I'm a bit cynical myself as a person. So whenever, you know, I hear all the magic wand approach to AI and how AI will basically change every company's life in 2 minutes, it rubs me the wrong way. And this company, Pecan, really took upon itself to deliver real AI and AI that actually works in the business setting. And it's far harder than people think. AI is not a magic wand. When it works, it's amazing, but it's not a magic wand. So helping organizations cross that chasm of adopting AI in a meaningful way is definitely something that I see as a huge, huge pleasure and gratification.
I love that you say that. First of all, the curiosity part, I think I completely agree with you. It's one of the most powerful tools that you have in your arsenal, not only as a CEO or founder, but actually if you also make that happen across the organization, it's for a reason trait number four in my book. But also what you're just saying about AI and all the hype that's going around there and the skepticism that's bringing that to the market because of people not delivering on it, shallow solutions. And so I really, that's also why I was looking forward to this call. Because if you go to your website, for example, it already starts in the first line, get the outcomes, not the hype, which, yeah, is something that's bold because you actually promise an outcome that people, that, yeah, matter to people. So that's powerful. So making then the bridge to your company, and when you started the company, I saw it was 2018, sorry. You're talking about problem solving. Curiosity is one of the things that it's high on your list. What was that problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution and not being delivered?
So speaking of curiosity, I think Noah, my co-founder, and I, we've seen the great success stories that came from AI in the early 2010s. So if you think of companies like Amazon or Uber or Spotify, even Facebook to some degree, they all really nailed it because they relied on AI and machine learning in their core. And I think we ask ourselves from pure curiosity, how is it that only the really big ones are able to build these types of advanced models? It's such an amazing technology. It has so much power. It can really transform your business. Why aren't we seeing more and more businesses doing it? You know, very naively from a curiosity, because curiosity involves also some level of naiveness. Why isn't everyone doing it? Why don't we see, like, you know, thousands of companies doing AI all over the place? And we started researching and trying to understand what prevents companies from really using AI. And apparently, it's far harder than one would imagine. It requires a very rare combination of business understanding to know exactly what problem you are actually trying to solve. And you know, AI is not a magic wand. You can't just say, I want to improve my revenue, and AI will go and generate more revenue for you. It just doesn't work this way. But not only understanding of the business problem, you also had to have very specialized and talented individuals like AI researchers, or for that matter, data scientists, who have all the proficiency and knowledge of building the models, building the data sets. It's a lot of manual, painful work. And then we realized that if you look at the companies that have slightly less resources, and most companies don't have resources like you know, Uber or Facebook,
Yeah, true.
you realize that they just can't afford, from a unit economics point of view, the investment and the time, the money, and the time that it takes to actually leverage AI. You'll need to hire so many expensive, proficient individuals, and you need to invest so much in infrastructure and tools, and you need to basically put down a year or 2 years of R&D before you see something that for most companies, it's just impossible. It's not plausible. And that's what sparked the idea. Can we create an engine that implements AI automatically for you, even if you don't have any data science experience, any data science knowledge, any prior implementation? Basically, the do-it-yourself, no-code, automated predictive modeling capability. That's our mission.
Yeah, exactly. So do you, I mean, who's your target audience then? Is that other software companies or is it end users that need a particular, that need to solve a particular problem in a particular category?
So our specific ideal type of customers would usually be consumer businesses that are mid and small size businesses. Because again, the large consumer businesses can afford building an
Yeah, true.
end-to-end team and pipeline and whatnot. For the mid and small size consumer businesses, and it doesn't matter if it's a financial application on the mobile, or if it's a small e-commerce or a retailer, or if it's even a consumer services business. As long as they have consumer data, they are ready to implement predictive AI. They are ready to ask questions of their data, like which customers are going to buy more, which customers are going to buy less, what product should I recommend that customer, what is the future lifetime value of that customer, how much items I'm going to sell at a specific location or at a specific category. The kind of questions that once you have an AI answer to, you can really optimize your business from the kind of grounds up. You can retain better because you know exactly who you should be targeting. You can increase lifetime value of your customers because you know exactly how to increase share of wallet. You can, for example, optimize your supply chain, which is a huge headache when it comes to consumer. So what AI gives you on the enterprise side is the foresight. Instead of just looking at the rearview mirror of the car, you don't want to drive a car and just looking at the rearview mirror, right? You'll be navigating based on past events. Bad idea. It's very much the same case when it comes to predictive AI. You want to see what's going to happen so that you can optimize in accordance.
You make a critical point there because a lot of companies think about, okay, it's the generative AI kind of hype that's currently going on. You got a large LLM, you ask a question and it comes back, which is typically looking at it from the back mirror, so to say. And what I see with you is indeed this whole world of foresight, that it's about predicting things with accuracy, with high accuracy, as I've seen on your website.
It's exactly this point because, you know, there's so much hype about generative AI and LLMs and GPTs, which are amazing on some domains. We have to remember, you know, we humans, we always use human language and we call something artificial intelligence. Eventually, these are models, and every model specializes in one aspect. Yeah. LLMs, for example, textual LLMs, are phenomenal in summarizing historical texts or in producing texts that mimic historical patterns that they've seen. They do that better than any model, and probably better, for sure better than me, probably better than many of us. But when it comes to what you would probably consider as the hallmark of intelligence, making predictions about the future, LLMs are actually not great at all. For the enterprises, for businesses, not for consumer, not for the end user, for businesses, being able to predict the future is far more important than basically anything else you might be thinking of. If you know, ideally it never happens, but if you knew exactly everything that is going to happen with 100% accuracy, you would have the best business on the planet, full stop. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between how cool and amazing and mind-blowing and experiential the Gen AI LLM type of an approach and what actually drive business success. And again, this is not me saying don't use agents to develop better processes, or don't use other you know, code generation to increase R&D productivity. These are all very important additions to the business, but that won't make it you know, live or die. That won't make it the true success story of a business. If we are really looking for the type of AI that changes the business trajectory, it's for sure historically proven the ability to make predictions and optimize your actions based on that.
Exactly. Now, you started the business in 2018. Let's not go back too far.
It feels like I started it in 1918.
So around that time, yeah, I mean, yes, AI was coming and machine learning was a lot in discussion and so on, but it wasn't as powerful as it is today. What was a thing that you decided to bet on that has proven now to be, you know, sort of a game changer to where you are right now? Was there one thing that you could pick out, okay, that was a good decision?
I would say for sure, deciding that we go all in on small and mid-sized businesses. There are many technologies and many products out there that specialize in AI and predictive AI for large enterprises.
True.
But they require know-how and infrastructure and investment that only enterprises can afford.
Yep, true.
No one addressed the longer tail, the mid and the small size enterprises. And we've decided with our technology and depth of capability, this is what we're going to do. It's hard. If you think about building a SaaS business, you know, the first thing investors will tell you, whatever you do, do whatever you'd want. Don't sell to the mid-size and small enterprises. Go for enterprise, go for large enterprise. They can pay, which is
true.
Probably true in most cases. But for our vision, what gets us kind of ticking is serving the mid and small size enterprises.
Exactly. Because you give these people, I mean, I've read the word democratizing a couple of times around like your profile. You give that market a capability to compete with the larger ones. So for them, it's a much more valuable investment to make.
Yeah, I mean, you know, eventually, and again, we have enterprise customers. We love our enterprise customers. It's not like I'm against enterprise in any way, but when I have a small business that is telling me to my face, hey, we bleeded churn customers. We lost velocity. We were at risk because of the churn we had. And since we are using Pekin's predictions, we are back on track to healthy growth. You really feel like you've done something meaningful in life. It's a phenomenal sensation.
Exactly. Yeah. And we talked a little bit about the traits of my book before we started. And one of the things that you highlighted as fundamental to your business is this trait number two. Actually, it starts actually with trait number one. Acknowledge you cannot please everyone, because you decided from the beginning you were not going to please the enterprise and the mid-market and everybody else. It was particularly the mid-market because of a particular problem that they're facing. But the second one, you said, okay, trait number two, offer something valuable and desirable. And yeah, I mean, you use the word real there, real value. And on your website, like I said as well, it's like outcomes, not hype. That those two together, what have you done to ensure that the company's laser focused on executing on that? And what has that meant? When did you see that picking up as something you say, hey, we're on the right track?
Well, Ton, I couldn't agree more that being focused, aggressively focused, and understanding exactly what is the valuable thing you're doing and that you do best is probably the number one important thing you have to make as a CEO, a decision you have to make as a CEO. I think, to me at least, it was very clear that they go hand in hand and that we have to understand where we shine the most. And as I mentioned, to us, through exploration and experimentation and comparison with competition and all of the things you do as a company to understand what is your strongest selling point, to us, it was quite quickly, quite clear. We have a set of use cases around consumer behavior that are relevant for those type of companies I mentioned, like consumer businesses, e-com, fintech, and so on, that for that segment of small and mid-sized enterprises, I'm very confidently can say no one can deliver the type of predictive capabilities in the quality and in the velocity that our platform can deliver.
Yeah.
In other areas, we can't compete. There are other giants out there. You should understand the predictive capabilities in the market are run by companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft. These are the giants of the industry, and they are putting chips on predictive. But
True.
they don't have the capability, they don't have the technology, they don't have the product to serve the small and the mid-sized enterprises because they presuppose so much capabilities in their customers' repertoire. So we said, this is our area, this is where we're gonna shine, this is what is gonna feed both our technological and product roadmap, obviously, because you
Yeah.
have to become better and better to continue and create that moat, but also the positioning, the marketing story, which is so crucial because people don't know what they don't know. And you can't go through, 5 hours of education with each prospect and customer. So you have to find a way to really explain why they should be working with us and not someone else.
Completely agree. It explains so well what you're saying there. The moment you realize I cannot please everybody, because a lot of companies think, okay, we have a horizontal solution, and yes, everybody could technically work with it. But the moment you constrain yourself to say no there, you can actually find the spots where you can actually, you can make that gap wider and wider, even if it's against the large giants like Google and Microsoft and Amazon. You actually you become the only logical choice, and they have nothing to do in that area, and they likely know. Or you position yourself in such a way whereby they say they will never go there because it will hurt our business. We are not utilized for this. So there's so many different ways to do that, and I like it that in your story. There was something kind of going on in my mind here. Well, one thing, a lot of times it's about saying what you say yes to, but what are you particularly saying no to? Because sometimes these deals come along and say, hey, but this is really a good deal, and it's maybe a little bit out of our segment on the left or on the right, still say no to it. Do you have any parameters there?
Absolutely. So I think you can't always say yes. I think that's a given now. Everyone understands that a startup has to be focused, and saying no is literally the definition of being focused. But we also live in reality. And when it comes to making decisions in your day-to-day, you always consider different considerations, right? You need to take into consideration your product focus, your go-to-market focus, your investment focus. And sometimes there are conflicts. Sometimes you can, for example, see a huge deal sitting on the table. And if you just take it, you'll have so much, nice revenue you can enjoy. But it's a little bit of a defocus. And, it's a dilemma. You're not sure what you should be doing. For us, I tried to take a relatively aggressive approach. And by saying aggressive approach, I say there has to be an extremely good reason for us to do something which is not part of our strategy that was developed in detachment from the day-to-day opportunities. We are looking at the bigger picture, we understand exactly where we want to be, and we develop the strategy. If something that comes across doesn't fit the strategy, it has to have a very good justification to be included in our investment. So I'll give you example of a very good justification. And I don't think there's a formula that you can quantify. Eventually, things boil down to gut feel and intuition and group conversations. But examples would be if we are looking at a very large deal that can really, put an unexpected acceleration to growth, then it warrants a discussion. It's a fine line, and you have to be very careful, but startups need to do that sometimes. It's part of the
True.
game. Another thing is if it opens up an opportunity for an important collaboration, for example, partnerships. If there's a good reason to believe unexpectedly that if you make some kind of an investment which is not in your focus at the moment, but it can open up an avenue for a completely new channel or a partner, again, you'll have to risk assess, but eventually it's a justification. I'll give you an example for something that I don't think is a justification. For example, should you incorporate some form of an LLM to your product, just because everyone are expecting LLMs in their products today? To me, the answer is absolutely no.
Exactly.
You have to incorporate whatever you need to incorporate so that you can realize your strategy and the value that you promise to your customers. If you go ahead and you invest resources in an empty shell type of an approach, just to say that you have some kind of a cool technology, I don't like it. I don't believe in it. And I don't think it's a sustainable long-term success. You might close a few deals now because people are experimenting or are hyping about something, but ultimately you will be losing, in my mind, the race.
Yeah.
We are leveraging LLMs in our product in many different ways. We build some capabilities that are fundamental to LLMs, but we do it only when it's the right product decision and not where it's, you know, like nice in front of the crowd.
I like how you say that. It's the empty shell, because many people think it's not, and it's like the tick in the box, and now we have it as well. But it doesn't lead to differentiation. And yeah, there's many ways to solve a problem. And at the end, you know, it's not about, you can have very feature-rich solutions out there that will always outperform any type of product. But it's not about that. It's about how you solve a problem in a way that others cannot. And that has to do with your own choices, who you're for and who you're not for. So thanks for that example. Now, 2018 till 2025, 7 years. And not everything, of course, always went well. Has there been a point where you said, okay, we made a strategic decision in the product or in a particular technology, or we made a particular bet that didn't work out? And what did you learn from that?
Yes. So first of all, it's definitely not for us, but I think for most companies, it's definitely not a linear trajectory. And there are ups and downs. It comes with the territory, and you have to love it and you have to embrace it. Otherwise, you lose your mind. Sometimes at the very same day, you get 5 pieces of good news and 6 pieces of bad news and 2 pieces of amazing news, and you are like mind blown. So it's an emotional roller coaster. The cliche is absolutely true. For us, also on a larger scale, it's been a roller coaster. We started and grew very fast. And I would say even maybe a bit too fast, when my head already started to spin, in all honesty, from how fast it was. And we've made a wrong bet. Without going into too much details, we decided to bet on a specific use case within the realm of predictive modeling that we thought is going to be a huge, huge success. And for several various reasons, it ended up being an unsuccessful use case that didn't move the needle. And we invested a lot in that use case. And it took us too much time to realize that it's actually not a really needle mover, business valuable use case. And that cycle of making the investment, developing, going with it to market, selling it, helping our customers realize that use case, and then basically realizing that it's not working well. It's a long cycle. It's a painful cycle. And it ended up obviously being a pain for us. But we've learned to better, I would say, better verify that a direction we are pursuing is valuable, because we really believe in value. We don't believe in just fancy terminologies and, you know, nice titles. We could have stayed in that business, by the way, but we decided to deprecate it because it wasn't valuable, not because it wasn't selling well. And
can you make a, what is the distinction between that? Because I can see your point there, but maybe at least a little bit of explanation for the people listening.
Sure.
It's a good business, but it's not valuable.
Yeah. So you can, like, you can sell things, especially to larger organizations. You can sell things that actually don't have ROI. You can sell things that either look shiny, sound shiny, or smell shiny, or all of the above.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if you put yourself in a rigorous test of, you know, did I make a change? Did I actually added value to the system? The answer could have been no in many cases. And for us, it was something we couldn't accept. And the fact that we were able to sell and grow with that use case wasn't enough. And it's a hard decision. It's a very hard decision because ultimately you're a business and you have to justify deprecating something that is profitable and you're selling it well. The justification was that there's a huge difference between short-term and long-term business success. You can sell, you can probably retain maybe for the first year, but when you sell something that is not really valuable, you'll end up losing your customers.
Let me make a small interruption here. Zohar just made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from typical SaaS playbooks. He explained how they depreciated a profitable, growing use case because it wasn't valuable enough to customers. They could sell it, they could retain it for maybe a year, but they knew that customers would eventually churn when they realized the value wasn't really there. This decision, killing something that's making money, reveals why Peakon has such exceptional retention. They're playing the long game, betting that real value beats short-term revenue every time. And that's what remarkable software companies do. They focus on the essence, not the noise. And they build valuable and desirable software, not just viable. And then they create fans, not just customers. And that's noticed. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And one thing I'm super proud about is that with our offering and the value that we deliver, we almost never lose customers. And our NDR, which is the net dollar retention, is super positive and high because we are committed to the value. And customers today are so sophisticated. If they can realize value, they will spend with you money because they are looking to realize value.
Exactly. Well said. Well said. So, thinking a little bit like, how has this changed the way you make decisions today? But I think that the central word is value. Is that correct? Any other
yes.
aspect to it?
I would say value. And I would just add one more thing that I think I learned from the last years. Don't be afraid to kill things quickly.
True.
There's,
True.
We are all driven by a fear of missing out, by FOMO. We all think, well, if I just get this, few more months of investment done right, it will explode and be amazing, and we will all dance until the morning. In reality, and you can see it sometimes with employees that are underperforming, with features that are underperforming, with specific strategies that don't pan out. The earlier you kill something, the better. I think I haven't experienced ever in my 7 years of running this company a situation where I thought I needed to kill something. And by waiting, I said, whoa, thank God I didn't kill it earlier. Never.
True. It is true. Yeah, it's that dead end road that you have to acknowledge, and you have to be open to acknowledge it and be okay about it. I mean, I've seen this so many times in my career, and it's I also can't think of a situation where things started to improve because we just waited a little longer. It's sort of you got the gut feel and you have to kill it. But it's the emotional thing that's going around it. It's the sunk cost that is connected to it.
Exactly.
But at the end, like you say, it's all about customers and whether customers are going to stay with you for longer. Which brings me to trait number six in my book. You also mentioned this as one of your favorite, create fans, not just customers. How do you go about that distinction? Because a customer, of course, that's paying, a lot of people will say, that's a good thing. But you actually said, okay, it's this fandom. It's this sort of Uber customer feeling.
Absolutely. I would say if I had to choose one thing, obviously you want to have a few, but if I had to choose one thing that the company should be obsessed about is creating fans. The difference between a customer and a fan to me is enormous. because a customer, even a satisfied customer, is exactly what it is. It's a customer that is satisfied and is paying, and it's amazing. A fan is your growth engine. That's what I think about customers who are fans. First of all, if you can't make a subset, not all of your customers would be, you know, raving fans of your product. But if a decent subset of your customers are fans of your product, then you have the validation that you're doing something right. Because people don't become fans just because of a nice, you know, deck, or because of a nice discount or whatever you gave them. They become fans only if you really solve a problem for them. Really solve problem for them, they will become your fans. And what a fan will do, they will talk to their network, they will provide testimonials, they will provide reference, they will become your best account executives. They will sell your software far better than anyone from your company. Because the moment a prospect is talking to someone who's working at Pecan, naturally, they wear the skeptical hat because that person wants to sell me. They want to sell to me the software. And, you know, people will say things, people will do things. But the moment they're talking to their colleagues, to their peers, to their network, and they hear, hey, Pecan helped me reduce churn by 10% in 1 month, it's a done deal.
True.
So we are obsessed with providing the best software, the best value we can to our customers, so that the more fans we have, the larger eventually the value for us. And I'm so grateful we have so many of them.
Yeah. What have you learned over time that helps in getting better at it? Because I mean, it often starts with, the whole department of customer success very much is at the end. But in a lot of companies, I see, okay, it already starts at R&D, the thinking, what creates a fan, and then it's marketing, and then it's sales, and it's the whole cycle at the end. What have you learned?
I would say it's funny, but it brings us back to the discussion we had about curiosity.
Yeah, true.
Because you really need to be curious, and part of curiosity is being a good listener or, sensitive to information. I think if you're honest with your customers, because people can smell bullshit from a mile away. If you're sure. honest with your customers, and if you ask them real questions, and if you're honest about the flaws and the gaps you still have, and you don't just spread promises that don't have any backup, if you do that, they will trust you, they will share with you, and then you will realize value together. And once you do that, naturally they become fans. People that work in businesses and use software, they want to become fans. They want something out of the ordinary to happen in their business. They want success stories. It's part of their personal motivation as well. But it has to be honest. It has to be real. It can't be a fake thing.
Well said, because it's really about it. It's also pretty much this internal drive from people. Even if you buy software that is dull, and it's at the end, it's a decision, it's an effort. They make an effort and they want to succeed with it, and they want to rave about it. Even if it's, I came from the finance world, financial software, payroll software. We had fans for that as well. So it's not exactly sexy.
Who would have guessed?
Yeah, who would have guessed? But it's about attitude and it's about mindset. But they would scream if you take it away from them. So that's also a good sign.
Very now, good.
Yeah, exactly. You've grown quite a bit since the start. There's been ups and downs in this case. What has been the most counterintuitive lesson that you've learned about scaling a software business?
I have a very easy, quote-unquote, answer to you. Mm-hmm. You can be hyper-efficient with a small team and just achieve more. It's quite phenomenal. We've been like you said, we've been through a massive growth, and then we had to unfortunately reduce force because of the changes we spoke about earlier and deprecating some of our offerings. But at the end of the day, the company today runs, it's not that we can achieve more per capita. We literally achieve more in total, although we are far less people, because the way the company is structured and the way people are empowered and the way talent is being acquired is just optimal for what we are trying to achieve. And sometimes more people creates more inefficiency.
True.
And things literally fall between the chairs and end up not being executed the way they could. So the biggest lesson I had is, even if you are trying to grow really fast like we are, you don't need to rush into hiring. Hire, and people understand it, because everyone wants to be part of a success, right? Yeah. Every employee that works for Pecan knows that they have a crucial, critical role in the success of the company. So they will work as hard as possible so that we won't bring people that we don't need to bring.
Well said. Yeah, it's this, I mean, I've come to love this metric ARR per employee, because it says a lot about that leverage that you talked about. A lot of people say, well, we have a high ROI or a high revenue per employee, but I think sales. But no, it's the whole company. And it goes back to your point also. It's okay, it's already, it starts with, okay, who are we for and who are we not for? That decision about where you create the most efficient sales process, the most efficient customer to fan ratio, all of these things help.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and then the curiosity brings the rest in terms of the decisions that you take. And of course, it's all about, we talked about that before. Some of them are gaps or no, it are bets. And sometimes you take a little bit of risk, but that's how it moves forward. But at least you're focused. Let me see. Talking about that, success. I got one question around that. And then I also want to talk a little bit about selling the idea that you talked about earlier on. But how has the definition of success changed since you started and where you are right now?
I think from a very broad perspective, it didn't change a lot, because the mission of the company didn't change in details. Mm-hmm. We started as, we are going to bring predictive capabilities to every company out there, and that is still the very thing we are pursuing. I think what has changed from a success point of view is the ability we've developed over the years to monitor and track KPIs, and most importantly, leading KPIs. So I am in a position today not only to tell you how we are doing now, I can also tell you how we'll be doing next month, next quarter, even 2 quarters into the future. I'm practically predicting, and I'm doing it, first of all, because we also use Pecan internally, but also because we've learned to be extremely data-driven. So to me, success remains the same thing. Every company on the planet that uses Pecan to make predictions and improve its business is one additional V to our success. And the more, the merrier. This is what we wake up in the morning for. But if you ask me operationally, we have probably more than a dozen KPIs that we are taking to quote unquote be successful.
And then the big question comes up, like, how do you decide on those dozen KPIs? Because I also see a lot of companies that say, well, we track everything, and that's too much.
It's very funny that you mention it, because we are a company of data people and data scientists. And we can torture the data. We can really kind of, go into a rabbit hole, and it's also a risk. So we are conducting a lot of analysis. I would say we are conducting a lot of analysis. We are very data driven, and we are trying to leverage our internal capabilities, obviously, and some very good old fashioned data analytics and data science. And you end up for, I would say, we are trying to be minimal on KPIs, but to measure those across the business. So you have financial KPIs, you have sales KPIs, you have marketing KPIs, you have SDR KPIs, product KPIs, success KPIs. So if you look at the entire picture, when I wake up and I'm starting to look at the KPIs, it's quite a lot of numbers, to be honest, maybe a bit too much. But I will say that as data people here, we're quite used to it. So for us, it works well.
And you start to pick up on things that maybe don't connect.
Yeah, it's funny again that you mentioned it because you're really touching on an interesting point. In academia, one of the research papers that Noam and I published was about humans' intuitive ability to digest multiple KPIs simultaneously. So it's funny, but we actually leverage that capability quite often.
Can imagine. And it's about connecting dots that systems sometimes don't see, but you see them as humans pretty easy. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say one sentence. Maybe some people won't agree with me. I'm not even sure I will agree with me tomorrow, but I think you can be as data-driven as possible. You can have all the KPIs, all the measurements, all the predictions, all the models, all of that. Eventually, you need someone that understands the business well to look at all of it and do some kind of a holistic integration that goes beyond a simple number or a data point. And I'm providing predictions for a living, and still I'm saying you can't rely end to end blindly only on data. A human in the loop for me, even when I run my business, a human in the loop for me is a crucial element.
True. I completely agree. Yeah, exactly. Who knows what it's going to be in 5 years' time? Maybe we'll laugh at it, but I think it's a good thing, and I hope it will stay something like that for a long time from now on. It's about the story that you're making up from all the facts, which is one thing that I still want to highlight in before we close. Trait number 9 in my book, you also highlighted as one very important that you strive for. Sell the idea, not the product. I mean, and you are end-to-end a product company. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of technology involved, but still you say it's selling the idea, not the product. How do you teach your organization to get good at that?
First of all, I'd say it's a challenge.
It
It
is.
it's a high risk, high reward, because if you sell an idea, then it's far bigger in everyone's head, both in terms of how they treat it, how they invest in it, how they measure it. And look, businesses, 99% of businesses don't care how sausages are being made. It's important that a sausage will be made. But the underlying way of making it, for that matter, if I'm not stretching the metaphor, is not that important. I always try to explain that if you go ahead with something like Picken, you're basically evolving as a company. It's a new mindset. It's a mindset where I'm gonna use my data in a smarter than humans. We don't know how to make predictions the way the machine does. I'm going to evolve into a company that leverages that machine intelligence into some action recommendation. I'm going to rely on that to make those actions. And it requires some level of mental shift. And if you present it this way and honestly, some will tell you, it's too much for me. I'm just looking for a, more automated way of ABC. Fine, you can work with us, you can work with anyone. But if people hear this honestly and transparently, and they understand that it requires a mental switch and they feel ready for it, then the collaboration just becomes completely different. That's why the high reward is so important in this point.
Exactly. It's about this gap that you create, and there's sometimes you just go a little bit too far for some people. For the right people, you're often just right.
You don't have to sell to everyone. You just have to sell to the people you need to sell to.
Exactly. And that is where the magic hides. And I agree with that. Super powerful concept, because you take people into a world that they cannot see right now, because you're doing novel things, and they are just used to their own world.
Exactly.
Powerful. To end, from your own experience as an entrepreneur and the lessons that you've learned over time, what would be a powerful do and a powerful don't that you would like to share with other entrepreneurs that aspire something similar to what you've done with Beacon?
Okay. A powerful do is be very transparent with your team and board. Don't hide, don't mask, don't embellish. I don't believe in it. I don't think it's the right approach. I don't think it ends up proving itself. I think people can handle the truth, even if it's not always fun or easy. But they can, like I said, people today can smell bullshit from a mile away. And as a leader of the company, you can't afford being perceived as a bullshitter. That's my do. And also probably my don't. The flip side is I don't believe in bullshitting people. I think both in front of the customers, both in front of the board, both in front of your internal team, if you will take the path of bullshitting or telling, you know, stories that don't match reality, it will come back and bite you in the ass.
Yeah, 100% agreed. I think this is these are some nice words to finish with. So where can people go to find out more about Beacon or to say hi to you?
So people are more than invited to either visit our website, beacon.ai, beacon like the nut. And I'm relatively active on LinkedIn. So Zohar Bronfman on LinkedIn, I would love to hear anyone's thoughts.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for sharing the story, the journey, the lessons learned. I keep following you in the next part of the journey. But yeah, good luck.
Thank you so much, Don. It's been a pleasure.
And this wraps up my conversation with Zohar Bronfman, CEO of Beacon AI. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.